Hello, hello, hello. We are back here at Hidden Apron Radio. This is episode 9, and it is really, really good to be back. I have literally been staring at this microphone for the last month, wondering when we could continue to drop our episodes, as I've had the bad case of bronchitis, full disclosure, and every time I try to speak, I would devolve into this coughing mess. Probably not something good for a podcast episode like this. Even worse, I couldn't laugh, so I would do this weird thing when people would like say a joke where I would just like silently throw my head back. It was like the oddest thing ever. Anyway, we are back from that unscheduled interruption here at Hidden Apron Radio, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world of food to try to figure out and better understand what our relationship is with food. And hopefully, we could do our part in getting people to cook more, eat better, and live well. And our guest for this episode is no exception. He's so interesting that for once I actually am just going to pull excerpts from his bio, because there was no way I could summarize his life in my own words. So here goes. Eric Sanerud is a fourth generation back to the land farmer who grows hops under his company Mighty Axe Hops, and his crop is selling to top breweries in Minnesota, from Fulton Beer, Dayblock Brewing, and many more. Inspired by the ideas of Edward Lindeman and Wendell Berry, he designed a first-of-its-kind cooking and food systems course and contributed to the University of Minnesota's food systems major, among the first in the country, while he was studying at the University of Minnesota. During these experiences, Eric was also a founding member of Urban Oasis, a sustainable food center, which won a competitive $1 million grant award to bring cooking classes, an incubator kitchen, and locally sourced catering to St. Paul's East Side communities. He then started Sandbox Center for Regenerative Entrepreneurship, wow, that's a mouthful, a beginning farmer incubator to address America's need for new farmers. He currently serves as a vice curator of the Minneapolis Hub of the Global Shapers, facilitator of Minnesota Young Food Professionals, and board member at Environmental Initiative. He's a TEDx speaker, Minneapolis St. Paul Business Journal 40 Under 40 honoree, and is writing a book called A Collection of Sorts, which he explores the complex beauty in the life of a young farmer. As you can tell, he's probably one of the most interesting young people. And I don't even know how he managed to fit all of that in his life to date. So you might be asking, why Eric? So for one, he's around my age, which is extremely rare to be if you're a farmer. And during the episode, you'll hear why this is a bad thing. We went to the same school, which also makes me regret my accounting major even more, knowing that I could have gone the route that he'd gone, especially when creating that food systems major. But really, I think it boils down and connects to something I read a few days ago from the New Food Economy about how fewer and fewer farmers are growing our food. Fewer and fewer farmers are controlling bigger and bigger farms. And while there's definitely something to be said about that, creating, you know, efficiency to scale, it's also had its fair share of problems. And the trend's only going to continue as companies look to increase profits. And that only means that the risk of something catastrophic happening increases. I know that sounds like doom and gloom, but it's really important, I think, for us to think about where our food comes from. And really, all our food ultimately traces back to a farmer somewhere. And it's easy for us to forget that fact, especially for us urbanites and city dwellers, because we sort of just see our food once it's already prepared or packaged in a grocery store, and we don't think about the impact of what trends there are in the farming world could affect. And it's not a very nice picture, but there's definitely hope in people like Eric. So in this episode, Eric and I delve a little bit into everything. And this is really a good follow-up to a previous episode we had with a different farmer in another part of the world, Ayesha. Because his current operation is in hops. And so we talk about that, how he got started in farming, creating a major while he was in college. I mean, who even has time for that? The need for there to be more and younger farmers. So if you thought farming is only for old people, or it's just too far removed from daily life and we really don't need any more farmers, you should really listen to this episode, both to get a sobering look at our food today and how young people like Eric are really trying to solve large, complex food issues and trying to get us a better plate on our table. As always, you can find more information, including show notes and links to the things that Eric and I talk about at our website, hiddenapron.com, where you could also find links to our social media, where you could follow us, Instagram, Twitter, our email address, hiddenapron@gmail.com. And after the usual housekeeping spiel, and without further ado, Eric Sanerud.
Eric, welcome to Hidden Apron Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited. I was looking through the list of people that I wanted to interview, and I was like having such a hard time finding someone who was in farming, but also, you know, was not only like born and bred a farmer. So when Callie introduced me to you, I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. So I'm super excited for this episode. So let's hop into, I think, the most interesting / fun topic, and probably the easiest to approach before the heavy stuff. Beer, just because I got back from Amsterdam and I've been drinking like beer nonstop because it's cheaper than water, so I figure this is a good place to start. So you're a hop farmer. First off, for the people who are kind of just drink beer without actually thinking about it, what are hops?
Hops are the spice of your beer. Hops are one of the three main ingredients besides water in beer. And hops are an agricultural product. We grow a lot of them in the U.S. A lot of them are grown in Europe as well, as you might expect. And there's hundreds and hundreds of varieties of them.
Right. So you said three ingredients. There's water, hops. What was the third one?
Yeast. Water, hops, yeast, barley.
Perfect, perfect. And so hops, where do they usually grow?
Hops, in their normal habitat, inhabit a lot of spaces across continents. They're a riparian species. They grow by rivers. But in a production or a farm setting, they grow in a production system that's kind of like a viticulture, kind of like when you're growing grapes.
Right.
Except for the trellises are 18 feet tall.
As opposed to six, or whatever
a vineyard is. And so what you use on a hop plant, the whole plant is a hop. And then when they're mature, which is every fall, you get one harvest a year, you pick the flower cones off. So the mature female plant produces cones that are technically flowers, but everyone calls them cones because they kind of look like pine cones. And if you Google hops, this is what shows up. And hops themselves, the cone or flower itself looks a lot like weed.
So yeah, a lot of people will recognize it
because of that. they're the only two plants in their family.
So they're actually related to weed.
Yep, they're the only two. I think it's the Cannabaceae family. They're the only two in there.
That's interesting, because then I begin to wonder why one is prevalent and completely legal, whereas one is much more controversial and hotly debated.
Well, I'm not sure why that's the case, but they produce vastly different chemical compounds, one of which, in hops' case, lupulin, produces the aroma and the bitter, and is also the preservative in beer.
Right.
And then, of course, cannabis has different effects on humans.
I'm sure they're complementary in some ways. So in terms of actual being a hops farmer, how is that different from, I guess, the stereotypical image of a farmer, you know, overalls on a tractor growing like wheat and corn? Like, what's different about being a hops farmer?
Well, I do work on a tractor a lot of the day, and I have fields just like they do. But because of the big trellis systems that the hops grow on, there's a lot of kind of construction-like work, maintaining those trellises and putting them up. Mm-hmm. And hops are also a perennial plant, which is like they come back every year, so you don't have to replant them. So if you're a gardener, every year you have to replant your tomato plants.
Right.
But if you had strawberries or blueberries or raspberries, those just come back every single year. So hops are perennial like that, or again, like grapes. And the other unique thing about hops compared to more of the commodified crops like corn, soybeans, is there's really specialty equipment you need to harvest and process your harvest. So you need a special picking machine and drying machine, a pelleting machine, and all sorts of kind of special equipment like that to work your system.
Is it something that, for lack of a better phrase, is there a steeper learning curve to learning how to farm hops as opposed to, let's say I just wanted a small garden somewhere where that was growing, like, I don't know, components for a salad, let's say. Is there a steeper learning curve?
Well, I think that the learning curve in agriculture is dependent on what you're trying to do. So in a backyard garden setting, you know, you can get away with not knowing a lot and still produce a lot out of there. But if you're producing for your income, if like you're trying to earn your money from farming, then the learning curve is really steep, because not only are you a farmer, and what people usually imagine of that is, like you said, sitting on a tractor and driving through the fields. Farming is a lot more than that. Farming is, you have to be a business person. You have to be an entrepreneur. You have to understand policy and likely advocate for yourself in the political circles. So you're kind of like a politician. And of course, you also have to be a scientist to be able to understand how your crop production system works. So how much water it needs and when. And then you need to be somewhat of a romantic, because all of your work is entirely dependent on Mother Nature at the end of the day.
Right. I was mentioning about that other friend of mine who I had on the podcast who became a farmer. And she was like, she credits a lot of her success having known all these business skills, that she's like, I just wish there was a way to get farmers that knowledge, because it's not, you're right, it's not just about like putting something in the ground and waiting for it to grow. But I think your case is quite interesting to me, because when I was at the U, I was actually on a project helping with the organic food movement. And I saw a lot of people trying to do CSAs, or community-supported agriculture for the listeners. But what was interesting was you actually were doing a CSA and transitioned to hops. Why is that?
Well, I think that CSAs, CSA farming is really tough, vegetable farming. It's the business model, I think, is harder. I think that you have to be, for me, when I was looking at my CSA and I was trying to figure out how I could turn this into a living, I had a hard time seeing the reward, the financial reward, to go along with how much work running annual vegetables is. And I saw the successful CSAs, and one of the things they had that I didn't have was being around for a long time. Many of the successful CSAs in Minnesota have been operating for more than 5 years, and some of them more than 20 years. And that gives them a significant leg up in, you know, the marketing and their consumers. And so I switched to hops because I was just looking, I loved farming that first year and doing the CSA, but I didn't love vegetables. And so I needed to figure out something else that was more for me. And hops really are for me. Hops are, because they're perennial in nature, the seasonal work is different than when you're running annual vegetables. The product, of course, is different. I really like beer, obviously, and this gives me a great excuse. And it's just an entirely different thing. You know, it's still farming, but everything else about it is different.
So is it fair to say that it's a combination of not just the fact that the production of the actual vegetables and farming it is difficult, but it's also then you have this other piece of, like, you got to find ways to market that to, I mean, it's in the name, right? Community supported. And if there's no one there buying from you, because they're buying from someone who's like 20 years older just because of brand name recognition, that does sound like a lot of work.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that for vegetable production, I don't know, you know, very much about it compared to people who have been doing it for longer than me. But just for me personally, it seemed like a very difficult space to earn a living in.
Yeah.
And it's not that hops farming is easier, but because it's a little newer, my marketing is, and because it's a specialty crop and I'm like directly to like only a handful of buyers, it's been easier for me to market the hops for sure than the vegetable CSA.
Would you say it was helped also because of, I remember I was staying at an Airbnb when I was there about a month ago. And they said this whole, the law, how it changed for craft brewing or something like that. I know I left Minnesota like shortly before it had happened, but some new law happened where they could, I think it's related to like Surly, where suddenly craft brewing in Minnesota is like booming. Is that?
Yeah, they call it the Surly Bill, and it basically allowed tap rooms to exist and operate in Minnesota.
Did that affect hops farming?
And how? Not necessarily. I mean, before the Surly Bill, there was not that many craft brewers, and there also like weren't any hop growers in Minnesota at that time. So The Surly Bill allowed more tap rooms to open and craft beer to become bigger. And then as craft beer got bigger in Minnesota, people started to wonder, well, what if I grew hops for the craft brewers? Mm-hmm. And I hate this. I hate this. And I don't, we don't call ourselves this, but like the craft hops mm-hmm. movement definitely grew and starts in locales around the nation that have strong craft beer movement.
Why, you know, why do you hate it, by the way?
I don't like it because it's like every farm product is craft in a way. It's not quite the right descriptor, you know, and it's not like they're not like made by hand or picked by hand or whatever, you know. It's just hops, and I grow them in a certain way and for craft brewers specifically, you know, so it's a little different, but it helps. You know, when I say craft hops, it makes you think of things that are true about my operation.
Yeah. There's the,
I just don't like it for a lot of reasons. That's just kitschy. It's silly.
Yeah, it's
like, I'm just a hop farmer. Like, and I happen to have, you know, this many acres instead of the big guys out west who grow commodity hops for, you know, AB InBev. You know, that's a different story.
Right, right. It's almost, I was at a, you know, these big, huge trade fairs where, like, Walmarts mm-hmm. and Targets would look at the food suppliers. Yeah, and
all the fucking names, dude. All the natural craft, dude.
It's like the minute they'll walk past you, but the minute you say certain magic words, like big one when I was there was gluten-free. Oh, they are on it. They are on it.
Ooh, gluten-free, protein-enhanced.
Yeah. Oh man, I feel like they should do a whole linguistics course on just these. Like,
it's oh, that, oh my god, my favorite thing is going to grocery stores and just seeing the branding on food. It's fascinating. I love grocery stores.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's an urban legend, but like I've heard of someone making like gluten-free water. Like, when did we ever have gluten water to begin
with? Bye. Oh,
I do want to go back to that grocery part later on, especially with the food major course you did. But going to the college years, and mm-hmm. I'm really bummed that your course came out in 2013 after I had already graduated, because I kid you not, I would have quit accounting to take your major. No lie. I think there was a quote online that you put, like, accountants aren't born.
Just born and neither are farmers. We both need to be trained.
Unfortunately, I was one of the ones who were born, because it was like pre-decided that I had to go into accounting. I was like, Dad, you need to put me in culinary studies. Like, nope.
Secret? Not secret. My grandpa started an accounting firm, and now my aunt runs it, and my dad's a CPA. It's kind of, because my family also, accountants are born.
Well, we share that, because my whole family is also accounting. I was the only one who managed to slightly break free. But going to that college bit, because you've been interested in this, but what got you initially interested in studying about, you know, the environment and food?
Honestly, the reason that I got so interested in that stuff, I went to college, I went to the U, and freshman year I was just like taking a bunch of different courses and things I thought I was interested in. Mm-hmm. And the sustainability, it was, I think it was like Intro to Sustainable Engineering or Sustainable Systems. It was in the engineering college. Anyway, the professor there was the most interesting, and the one I got along with most or whatever. And so that's why I signed up for more sustainability stuff after that.
Okay.
And then that's this kind of, the projection from there was I participated in an experiential learning class called HECUA. That was just the most important thing in my educational career. Mm-hmm. Really showed me that there were more than one way to learn, and that there were real issues in the world, and that even though I was, you know, 19, I could do something about it, or at least try. Yeah. And that was an incredible experience. And what I learned from that was that while sustainability and renewable energy were really, really cool, it wasn't something that I was that passionate about. I was frustrated because with energy, it felt to me like we can't interact with energy as well as we can with food. So if you're sitting in a room and your lights are on, you have no idea if that's solar or wind or coal or nuclear. You experience it the exact same way, right? Mm-hmm. But with food, if you sit down at a table and you have multiple different dishes of various carrots, for example, one that you grew in your garden, one that was root cellared by a farmer down the road, and one that you buy at the store, you're going to have a different experience with each of those carrots. And both from a flavor experience, but also there's so much more to food than just what it tastes like or how many calories are in it.
Oh, totally. Right?
There's the whole story. Like, the carrot in your garden is probably always going to taste the best, even if trained scientists would tell you that it doesn't, because you have the experience of growing it, you know, and caring for it. And so I think that a lot of that is why I got into food, because it's just so much more visceral.
Yep. I think like food is so much more than just like fuel for the body, right? I mean, there's even coming from the historical aspect, like entire histories are contained within food.
Yeah.
And a lot of identity stuff is in it. But going back to Hekiwa, and I'll include it in the show notes, by the way, because I think I know a couple of friends who went through that program too, and I think it'd be a cool thing for people to search into. Because
you could share that with them, and they would probably share the story.
Yeah. Because my next question actually had the exact same words that you just mentioned, which is like experiential learning. And I at least when I was in college, I was actually quite frustrated trying to teach myself anything related to food, because it was very like cerebral, right? I mean, you could read about it, but without access to a garden, I couldn't really, you know what I mean? I couldn't connect with it. And so How did you go about, whether it's through Hekiwa or your own, how did you go about teaching yourself on a subject that I think requires a lot of experiential learning?
Like, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was my other big, in college, I spent a lot of time thinking about and arguing for more experiential learning, especially as it relates to sustainability and especially of food systems, because there's just no way to experience farming without doing it.
Exactly.
Right. And farming is central to the food system. And then there's no way to experience cooking without doing it, and that's central. So I think for me, I got really lucky, because after I had found that passion for food, I just kind of was talking to everyone about it. And I fell into a couple of opportunities. One was to help develop that cooking class that teaches students how to cook, and not just like the science of cooking, which exists at the U, which is a very sad way to look at cooking. Oh, it's like cooking, like here's how you cook something to eat, instead of like cooking a potato a million ways, cooking it, which is just silly. And then you end up with, I was in through that course, I got connected and started to learn about that food system major that was being discussed at that time, and was able to engage with that. And then the final piece was, I'm lucky enough that the family farm is still around. And so I started growing vegetables that one of those summers in there. And that's how I experienced the farming side, right?
Yeah. Before we go into the actual major itself that you helped create, what then would you say? So let's assume, for example, that you didn't have the farm and you're just another accounting student who's interested in learning about food, you know, how would you go about trying to teach yourself about it if you didn't have the same access that you do now, or you weren't as lucky, let's say?
I mean, that's one of the core problems I think we have in addressing our challenge of not having enough farmers in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of like one of the ways, one of the big gaps that I see. So basically, if I didn't have land in the family, I would be relegated to trying to learn how to farm while gardening, you know, either in my apartment or in a community garden or whatever. And that experience is really valuable and has a lot of amazing things about it. But unfortunately, community gardening or Stravia gardening in your backyard, it only teaches you so much. It doesn't prepare you to be a farmer. Farming is a whole nother level above gardening. And if I didn't have access to the farm, I wouldn't have been able to start. I just wouldn't have started.
Yeah.
You go out and rent a quarter acre, which is what I planted. You can't go out and rent a quarter acre to grow vegetables on. That's not just sitting there. There's no structure that exists to take young people who are interested in learning about farming to a space where they can physically do it. Very few of those. Some of them exist in colleges. So at the U, we have a student organic farm where you can kind of practice farming. But even there, even there, that's more of an apprenticeship program where someone else is telling you what to do and in what order to do it in and sells the stuff. So really, you're an intern. And when you're farming and you're running your own farm, as we talked about before, you know, you're everything. You're marketing, you're growing, you're deciding what to do and when and how, you know, and with who. Like, there's just a million things, right? Mm-hmm. And it's important to have that little internship experience, but that's the internship experiences don't make farmers happen.
Yeah.
Steps beyond that need to be there.
It's almost like a, this is me, maybe I'm just griping now, but it's almost like a wider commentary in education itself, because I feel like, you know, there is that disconnect where sometimes you don't get to practice what's in the book. I think for me, the only way I could get that experiential learning was like running a student group, for example, as the closest you could come to like being an entrepreneur. But let's go into that major then that you mm-hmm. helped. Like, what, I guess, what's the framework for how you get a student from point A where they know, let's assume, nothing at all to where you want them to be after they've graduated?
I would say that, for one, the major is still relatively new, right? Mm-hmm. It's only a couple years old, and so it continues to be changed and redefined as students enroll and as, you know, we, or as the, you know, the administrators and the professors hone their coursework, that sort of thing. But I will say that the intent of the major is not to produce new farmers, which I think there's a track in there that's called organic food food production or food production systems, and that's great. But it's still not intentional with creating farmers, which is, I think, a big challenge and a big opportunity that they could be doing more of to address. But the major itself has multiple tracks. Some of them are focused on policy. Some of them are focused on marketing agricultural products. That's more of a commodity food system track. There's the organic production track, and then students can create their own. And one of the things that happened as the major was being discussed was originally it was supposed to be the sustainable and organic food systems major. Okay. And now those words are all missing. And that's because it's a messy process to get something like that and a change like that through at agricultural school at the U.
Right.
There's a lot of tradition there. There's a lot of history there. And there are people who are very dug in on the, industrial versus not industrial sides of the food system. And they like to argue with each other. And I think the biggest thing that happened in this was that, one, we're really, really glad it happened, because it's difficult to get people to compromise. It's difficult to create new things and create change at a university that large. So we're really, really lucky to have it. But also at the same time, because of how many compromises had to be made and how much kind of personality and political issues came in, mm-hmm. we did not end up with the best major we could for the students, right? Because mm-hmm. as a university, sure, we should have a food system major, and it should allow students, and every student should learn in that food system major about the various scales of the food system in our country and how that affects the world. And every student, no matter if they're going to be an organic farmer, that's what they want to do, or if they want to sell and trade corn, right? Everyone should have a basic understanding of food production, of consumption, of nutrition, of food science, of markets, of policy, and then they can apply that general broad knowledge to their particular area. But at least they understand a segment of how big of a complex of a system we have with food.
Yeah.
And that's the main thing that this major, like from the pedagogy of the major, is really focused on that. And that's something that I think was done very well.
Yeah.
We do want that.
I mean, it is Minnesota. I feel like it's the right place to have something like that. And I remember having that conversation with the chef over at Heartland, Lenny Russo, where we were talking about, he was just throwing policy and all the stuff that goes into our food. And he's like, you know, if even college students don't know this info, what hope does the regular person have? But this was years before, you know, the major came out. So personally, I'm really glad something like this is there.
I almost feel like it should be like required. I mean, we eat like more than 3 times a day. I feel like we should know a little bit more, right?
It's like, you know, there's some requirements and like, you know, we should know how to read, we should know how to write, and we should know how to eat, right?
Yeah.
Like those are some really
tweetable quote.
You know, come on, you know, let's stick to that.
Yeah. If we had to look at it from like a behavioral perspective, right? Like, I mean, I think learning is good and all, but if it doesn't actually change or create a certain behavior, I think it's almost like, you know, it's just all in your head, right? Is there a certain behavior that you're hoping to see from a student who studies this field, you could say? Are there certain things that you want to see people do in their life, ideally, you know, politics aside?
Well, I mean, I think with the major, the important piece would be no matter where they end up working, whether it's with a food system related job or not, they have a more complex understanding of the food system.
Yeah.
And have been educated to have a lens that is, I would hope, slightly critical and slightly hopeful. Mm-hmm. And also, specifically, for the students who go through the cooking class, you know, the whole point is so that they're more comfortable cooking. And cooking is something that you just have to do to learn. And if they're more comfortable doing it, hopefully they'll keep doing it after the class. And now I know that the class has been doing some kind of surveys, both before and after the class, mm-hmm. When the course begins, when the course ends, to see how students' behaviors might have been affected, or at least attitudes towards cooking. Mm-hmm. But I don't know those off the top of my head. I mean, that's the thing, though. I mean, it is behavior change at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that experiential learning is what is trying to create.
Right.
And without even having a specific outcome, right? It's like, I want these students to cook more and be more comfortable cooking, but I don't care what ingredients they're using, right? I'm not trying to change their behavior so they only ever buy local organic, right? No, wow, I would love that. And that's what we cook with in the lab. It's never that is the only thing you can do, or that's the only way to cook. I think it's an interesting thing that when you're in academia, something I think about with this major in the class was, how do we encourage behavior change with experiential learning without pushing a philosophical or political ideal through the education? Because education is brainwashing. Education is, you know, like whatever, brain awakening, whatever we want to call it. And it's not about propagandizing. So it's hard to balance that.
Right.
Because there's also a part of me that says, well, I would want every student who leaves a cooking class to preferentially buy organic and local, and to push that on their friends and push it on themselves, because those are the things that I believe, local more so than organic, that we need to move towards a more balanced or healthier food system. So personally, I loved it. That's what they did. But I don't think that with an educator hat on, I'm not sure that's something that is totally fair to the student to do.
Yeah, no, I get you on the whole tough part, because it's almost like, how do you empower someone and give them tools which are supposed to be agnostic without coloring their own perception with what you want, right? But I think
that's literally impossible, but you have to try to do that, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's, I mean,
because the students look up to professors and... Hey, so I'm sorry, but either you want to pause the recording or something, but I got to turn this tractor on. I got to move it so I can get in the car and get on my way home. We can keep talking, but it's just going to be really loud.
So just do your thing and then just Skype me back.
Okay, sweet. All right. Call you back.
I had a little like chuckle after you left, because I think of all the people I've interviewed, I've never heard the... I mean, we've taken breaks in other ones before, but I've never heard the... Hold up, let me move my tractor real quick. I think this is the most badass one we've had so far.
I think that tractors are a lot of fun.
It's gonna be hard to top. So we were talking about the major and getting people to change behaviors, but it was actually a perfect time to take a break, because I wanted to switch into, this is quite the shift, into the actual heady, big macro stuff around farming.
I don't do my best to I mean, it's connected, right? I mean, the reason why I'll get into like how like my story farming connects to how I think about why we need, you know, what some struggles that our food system has, how we talk about like how the food major was designed to hopefully address some of those, like what Sandbox was all about, the farmer incubator, and then that all of that kind of ties into like how I talked in my TED Talk. So I kind of have this idea, this like big idea, more kind of organized now than I did a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. So I can do pretty good. We'll see.
Okay.
This is tough because it's super complicated. I want to be like concise enough to like other people could understand me. So that's all I'm saying.
I think the way I would see it is it's almost like a primer, right? Because I think that's what putting links in the show notes is for. And a good place to start would be getting back into farming. Because you say you're fourth generation, right? But online it said that you kind of rediscovered the farm. Like, what brought you back to farming? Like, is your family still involved in it? Or is it just you? Or somehow you graduated and you went back in farming.
Yeah, that story. So I'm the fourth generation of my farm to farm and on this land in Ham Lake, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Yet... I'm only the second to farm it for my living. So great grandpa farmed it, and that's how he supported himself and my grandma's family. Mm-hmm. And then neither my grandpa nor my grandma, nor any of my aunts and uncles were farmers, as their primary, income. And so I wasn't born there. I wasn't born at the farm. I wasn't raised at the farm. I was born and raised in a wealthy suburb called Edina.
That is
absolutely not the thing that you expect an Edina grad to go into is farming. And that Hekuwa experience where I got to see how farming was such a visceral and physical way you could try to work on larger issues, right? And I say to young people who want to ask how to change the food system, I suggest to everyone that first they attempt to farm, because there is no more direct way to change the food system and than to be a farmer yourself. Voting with your fork, voting with your fork and buying certain things certainly helps. Voting with your vote is something that we all need to do a lot more of. If you've noticed in the presidential campaign, food and food systems has not been mentioned. Or certainly is not any sort of issue that's being discussed regularly amongst any of the candidates. But voting with your livelihood, if you will, of becoming a farmer is certainly the strongest thing you can do to work towards a better food system if you are looking to create change.
Right.
So that's my story into farming, was just that I took that class in college and it exposed me to ideas and ideals and a certain amount of power that I thought I could take it on. And that was 5 years ago now. This is my fifth season. So I'm starting to kind of understand what it means to be a farmer. I think that this is the first year I would call myself a farmer.
Wow, 5 years later?
Yeah. Oh, and that's still kind of tentative. I mean, it's a super heavy title. You wouldn't just walk around calling yourself president of the United States. You got to earn that. And farming is the same. And just like in other parts of food, you don't call yourself a chef unless you're a chef, right? Then you're just a cook. There's a distinction. And it's an important title and an important word to maintain some semblance of gravitas or respect towards. And so I'm still kind of hesitant. It's different. I'm earning my living from hops farming now. And that helps me. That's an important aspect, I think, of being a farmer, is that you earn your living from it.
Did your parents think you were crazy for doing it?
I don't know. They've always been very supportive of whatever kind of route I take in my life. So it's hard to know if they had private conversations where they're like, God, what are you doing? But my favorite part about graduating from Edina and growing up in Edina and then farming was I kept pigs last summer, and my grandma came out when I was feeding them once, and she said, you know, imagine an Edina grad being a pig farmer, and that was pretty funny. I liked that. I was like, you know what? That's exactly how I want Edina people to think of me, as a pig farmer.
It's so subversive. Like, I bet you, like, in their head, they're like, where did we go wrong?
No, they're so proud of me. They're going to be happier that someone in the family is farming.
Man, that's great.
That's only the case in families that even where farming's a couple generations spread out, if someone grew up on a working farm, even if they never worked it for their own living, there's a tremendous respect and pride in that occupation.
Yeah, and I think, but, and this is partly sad and partly admirable, right? But like, you're the exception to the rule where.
God, dude, I know.
Brings me to my next question, which is obviously very leading. I think we all know where this is going to be going. But you know, how is farming outside of your case overall in general? How is farming in America changing? What are some things that because of the lack of people talking about it, especially with the elections, you know, where
yeah, it's hard to know, right?
It's hard to
know. So I mean, these are all going to be really generalized statements, and I know some stats off the back of my hand to provide some evidence for what I believe. So that's just kind of the disclaimer. I don't like making generalized statements, but it's also important for like getting a snapshot.
Right.
I think so for one, the most important trend I see in our food system is the loss of farmers. You mentioned that I was a rare case, and that's partly because I went to Edina and I'm farming, but also partly because I'm younger than 35 and I'm farming.
Right.
So there's every 5 years, there's an agricultural census done by the USDA. So just like the census of the population, mm-hmm. there's an ag census, which is obviously an ag census. And one of the things they track is the number of farmers, and then, of course, their demographic information. And that's where all the trouble starts for me is the number of farmers decreased by the overall number of people who were farmers, according to the USDA, decreased by about 90,000 in the last census data, which was, I think it was 2008, 2013. Mm-hmm. But we only gained 1,500 under the age of 35. So if we lost 90,000, we only gained 1,500 new farmers under the age of 35. So that's tremendous. That tells us everything we need to know about the state of our food system mm-hmm. in that one snapshot, because that shows us that farming is not something that young people are going into as much as we want, that farming is something that is not attracting change or innovation, that farming is something that is going to keep being the way it is because so many young people are not joining it, because it's the average age of a farmer is 58 in America. It keeps going up. And what we end up with is like a very like unchanging industry that is generally in decline. Because for me, as we lose farmers, it means that, but we're not losing like agricultural production at the same time. So one farmer is farming more and more land. And while that's not inherently a bad thing, you know, there is something to be said for efficiency, and maybe we all don't want to be back farming like it was in the early 1900s.
Right.
But there is also something that's not so great about that. So if you imagine the logical conclusion of this is when you have so few farmers, but they're so efficient that you have one farmer farming an entire county of land. And what you end up with that then is What's the point of the other people in that county? What do the other farmers do? What do the other farm families do? Your population declines. You have to close schools. There's no tax base. Churches close. Post offices close. There's no one to serve. And you end up with a total decline in rural communities. And then you end up with these weird kind of semi-rural, urban, suburban hubs that have like, you know, a really big Walmart and a really big dollar store and like a couple gas stations and some bars. And it's this weird, not really rural community anymore.
Right.
And at the same time, it also means that with one person farming so many acres, there's just no way that that one person is able to understand all of the complex inner relationships on that land. And so it's more and more difficult for them to manage it sustainably or to manage soil health or manage water runoff. And it also means that we have a system on an economic side that is tremendously vulnerable and tremendously not resilient, because already in this country we have 6% of farmers produce 66% of our agricultural output.
Oh wow!
And that's, again, that's ag census data. So that's 6% is 66%. So from an economist point of view, they're like, this is so efficient. Oh my God. Well, also it's super risky, because what happens if there's climate change, right? We already know that's happening. But even a natural disaster that goes through a certain area where 3% of those 6% of people farm, or an act of bioterrorism, for example. There's so many things that can go wrong and then have a way bigger impact on your economy and then the way we eat when there's only 6% of people producing that. And if that's the case today, there's just no reason why when we're losing 90,000 farmers and only gaining 1,500, that trend's not going to continue. Yeah. And so for me, it all starts with that number and that loss of farmers overall. That's the key metric that I start from.
Yeah, there's so many things to be said for that. I think like perfect example was the I think there was an article about a month ago about the bananas, because the world is only eating like I think 90% of the bananas. I'm probably misquoting. This is like one variety, and it got hit with this pest or this like this certain pest.
Yeah, it's like that can just totally wipe out our agricultural economy too.
Yeah. And it's
all on the same form.
I think what I was trying to get at is it's hard to, you know, I mean, I live in the city and I'm trying to think like, why should I care that there's less and less farmers, right? Because for me in the city, like I'm still going to get my food. Who cares if there's fewer farmers? But it's that last piece you said that I think resonates so much is the risk of my food can actually get pretty fucked up. You know, I mean, like when you say there's loss of rural communities, to be honest, if you tell that to someone who's miles and miles away, they're like, well, I don't care. I've grown up in a city. I've lived here all my life.
Right.
Like, but
the well, that's that in itself is an issue, because then rural folks feel like city folks don't care about them, and city folks feel like rural folks don't care about them. Mm-hmm. And that's a political and social divide that
right, exactly.
only leads us towards a worse future. Right. Like we have things that we need from each other. And we are different, and that's fine. And there's a lot of things we can learn from each other, and we can provide for each other that the other one doesn't want to do or doesn't want to live.
Yeah.
But I think it's just like having a multicultural society. We should have a multi-geographical society, and we should value that.
Oh, that's yeah.
That's something that's a whole other conversation. But that's something that is deeply, deeply important to me. That we, because I grew up in a suburban place. I went to an urban college. And then now I live in a rural community, and I'm not wise enough yet to eloquently connect why I think it's so important that we value multi-geographic society. But I can tell you, I think it really is important. And someday I'll write a poem, and then it'll make more sense.
You're right. It's definitely a complex topic, and it's like, you know, how do you convey such a complex thing into a poetic and easily understood way? But I'm getting to the last few questions on this farming one. But one thing that stood out to me when you gave me that transcript of your TED talk is like, well, mm-hmm. in order to reverse or even overcome the loss of farmers is to show young people.
It's astronomical.
Yeah.
How many more people we need on the landscape?
Right.
You know,
like
I shouldn't be rare. Like, why am I special? Like, I hate that I'm special. But the whole problem is that I'm special, right? Like, that I'm one of 1,500 is just ridiculous. I mean, I know there's sampling error, right? And all sorts of other pieces. But the 1,500 number doesn't grow that much if you start to include sampling error, if you include other ways of defining a farmer. Like, you don't get very far.
You still have a big gap. We still lost 90K. A ton. Yeah.
And we still gained very few.
Yeah.
You know, like the one of the ways I like to think about this is when you're thinking about agriculture. So a lot of your listeners are probably more active in food and agriculture than the average person. If you think about agricultural policies and the conversation around ag that we have is, you know, about we should support organic and local more. And maybe we should get rid of some subsidies that are going to larger companies, or maybe we need to break up some of the larger companies because they're not respecting communities, the environment, farmers mm-hmm. anymore. And maybe we should do that. But also, when we come up with new policies, how do those affect the aggregate number of farmers in America? Do they lead to more farmers or less farmers? And that, for me, is an absolutely amazing way to kind of split hairs, but in a different way. And to look at policies and consider agricultural, you know, what people think about agricultural systems and what we need or what we don't need in a totally new way. And when you ask that question, I was in DC a couple months ago, when you ask that question to people who maybe that person and I disagree on a lot of what we want to see our food system be, but when you ask that question, they've not thought about it that way before, because everyone supports new farmers and everyone supports American farmers and American family farmers, right? But until you ask the question the right way, it can be hard to figure out if the policies they're supporting or the views that they're advocating actually do support new farmers. Yeah. And asking it like, will this create more farmers or less farmers in the future is an incredibly powerful tool to having that conversation and to perhaps helping you identify what sort of agricultural policies or food policies or purchasing decisions that you make.
Right. I work in like analytics, so getting the right, I can appreciate the importance of getting the right metric. So your email to me, I think like a couple of weeks ago, it was only two lines, but it actually piqued my interest because I will admit that I'm one of those people who've never thought of this metric that you brought up of farmer transitions. You're like, this is the most important metric. And I'm like, what the hell? Like most of the time we're thinking of like GMO labeling. Is it organic? You know, are we getting more yield? And you're like, wait, what? Farmer transitions? Like, we rarely ever think of that.
Yeah, that's never a headline, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes headlines, we get a headline for how old farmers are. Yeah. But even in those articles, they don't even talk about like this, the raw number of farmers. I think it's because it's a relatively complicated step to take from having less farmers to having a worse food system, right? That's right. Not like a thing that equates in people's head. Like, we all know that no farmers equals no food, right? Like, we're all familiar with those bumper stickers, no farms, no food.
Yep.
But, like, less farms, worse food. You know, like, it's kind of more nuanced.
Yeah, it takes a little more thought. But I wanted to go to something that you had put in your transcript of like, in order to close that gap, you know, there's one thing you wrote about showing people that there's a reward path to going into farming. Because, and here's the thing that I can't really solve is because, I don't know if it's the same in America, but at least in the Philippines, farming is almost looked down upon. Like, you know, sometimes parents will tell their kids, because my dad grew up in a farming family. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in the Philippines are farmers, but they're like, if you don't study hard enough, you're going to end up becoming a farmer. Who wants that? You know what I mean? So like, it's almost like it's a penalty. So what does that reward path look like to you of showing people like there is a benefit to going into this lifestyle and becoming a farmer outside of the nobleness or the nobility in the mission? You know, what does that reward path look like?
Well, I would say that it's an immensely challenging task. A lot of jobs are very hard, but if you can imagine being an entrepreneur and then having your boss / shareholders, investors be Mother Nature, who you can't control or talk to or anything, and then you also probably have investors or a bank or something giving you the money who wants to tell you what to do. And then on top of it, much of the year, you're working many, many hour day physical labor, very hard physical labor, and then going back and having to do all your other work. So I think for me, my pitch is that farming is immensely difficult. You must be an extremely good entrepreneur to earn a living at it. You must be extremely mentally tough and physically tough to be able to put yourself through how hard of a work it is and then how it could just be wiped out. Like, we had frost a couple nights ago and we ended up being okay. I think we'll see, but it's like, there's nothing I could have done about that. Mm-hmm. There was frost. And so you need a certain amount of mental fortitude to not just totally give up when something like that happens. And then there's just the whole romantic side of it all as well, that we're all familiar with, like going back to the land, and the spiritual connection to where your food comes from. And all of those aspects of farming are also equally valid reasons to get into it. But my new spin is that it would be an entrepreneurial challenge for anyone to succeed and to try. And that's why I would pitch people to start farming. If not for any of the idealistic ways. Like, I think, you know, one of the things, like, people want to go out to Silicon Valley and, like, be, like, some fucking, like, tech cowboy.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, fuck that. Like, just be a real cowboy. Like, figure that shit out, bro. You know, like, I know amazingly badass young people across the country who are farming, right? And they're super badass. And I know some people who are doing tech stuff, and, like, it's pretty cool. But, like, yo, man, like, your, like, little tech fingers from typing on a keyboard and stuff, you know, carpet tunnel kind of sucks. But, like, check out a farmer's hand sometimes, man. Like, yeah. Then you know who's, like, really putting in that challenging work ethic. So it's a lot of fun.
Versus the next Flappy Bird, as addicting as that game is.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean? I've never actually played it, but I've seen it.
So, like, what if farming was as sexy as, like, Mark Zuckerberg, right? Like, how many hoodies do I have to wear, you know, to, like, get society to think that farming is a really cool thing to get into? Because, you know, the first part of your question you asked, like, how does America view farmers?
Yeah.
And generally, like I said, you ask anyone, do you like farmers? And everyone's like, fuck yeah, dude, farmers rule. Yeah. But then we vote in ways that would make me kind of question that. We always demand lower prices for our food no matter what. And that makes me question that, because that's not how you support the beginning producer. That's how you exploit people.
Man. Don't get me started, right? On that.
I mean, like, let's, you know, I'm just saying that, like, it's interesting. There's like doublespeak happening, and there's all sorts of organizations that claim that they're speaking for American farmers or finally farmers. And really, it's tough, because sure, there's farmers who support what those folks are saying, but those folks and their boards are made up of primarily people who aren't farmers. They're traders or equipment dealers or whatever it is. And that's something you have to be real careful of, because I think that I honestly support, you know, American farmers. And I have a very nuanced view of that, and there's a lot of different reasons why I think farmers are not the people to be angry at. Mm-hmm. I get people angry at me on Twitter all the time when I'm like, you know, thank a farmer today, it's good things. And they're like, no, farmers are toxic, they're polluting everything.
Wait, what?
And oh yeah. And then I'm like, yo, man, like, we got the wrong target here. I'm not going to say that farmers don't create any pollution. We absolutely do. But there are certain reasons why farmers farm in the ways that they do. You know, there's cultural, there's heritage regions, but there's also, like, economic and systemic reasons that people farm in certain ways, right? If organic farming was the way you had to farm, if that's what the law said, right, everyone would be an organic farmer.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And right now, the law and the economic reality is you don't have to do that, and you don't have to be a really good steward of your land, and you don't have to cover crop, and you don't have to do all these things. So I think really the problem is a systemic thing. And if we want to get angry at anyone, it's time to get angry at, I hate to use all these stupid general terms, but, like, big agribiz, the business side and the policy side, the people who are controlling all of the farm policy and all of the conversation about farm and food policy. They are the ones that we should be angry at. They are the ones that we should have a populist uprising over, not at the farmer who's doing everything he or she can to, like, pay for their family to go to college.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that their kid doesn't have to do it. Because there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of, like, you know, I'm just not seeing farming being a great livelihood for my children, and I don't want them to go into it. There's that, a lot of that out in rural communities right now with the price of corn as it is. So, I mean, it's a difficult thing, because on one hand, it's like, yeah, I support farmers in America. And then on the other hand, it's, but I want my burgers for a dollar. You know, I don't want to take the time to have, or can't, I mean, I don't blame anyone, to have a nuanced understanding of, like, the messaging we're being told about our food system or about our farms. It's a complicated space. And if you really want to know things about it, you got to invest time in it. It totally sucks.
Our heads are being turned in the wrong direction, I feel. I mean, that's why I told you, like, this is a pretty touchy subject. So when I was at a dinner in Minnesota, that was actually part of my, like, closing speech. For me, it just hurts because, you know, I could see a friend of mine who would pay hundreds for, like, new shoes. And I'm here, like, I'm giving you the best, like, I went out of my way to find the best beef, the best rice, that, like, I'm cooking all of this. And you want a discount, you know, but you claim you want good food, like, where are we, you know?
That's so interesting, right? This is totally something that is going to be part of that we must move, like, the food movement. There's two pieces we must pick up on. Like, the public health world has to join our cause, because that's the only way you really get healthy people is with healthy food from the start.
Yep.
But then also the justice movement. And I don't mean just food access, but I mean, like, how is it that you can have, I was just at a conference like this. I won't say the name because that might be kind of mean, but like, I was just at a conference, very progressive, you know, everything was progressive. The bathrooms were transgender bathrooms, whatever, every down the line, right? Mm-hmm. It was an absolutely a progressive experience, but the food was fucking garbage. Okay, like the food was just like whatever the caterer happened to be, sourced from however they wanted, like no social standards, like not even like human, like, you know, human goodness standards, not to mention like farming practices. Like, that's not a thing that they think about. I mean, they might, and then they'll be like, oh shit, it's like way too expensive, so we can't. And then because the attendees aren't willing to pay for it. It's like, that's crazy to me that we have conferences of the most progressive, idealistic people in the Twin Cities. And that is not something that's a requirement.
Oh, dude, have you heard of the Best Food Conference?
Is that the one? I mean, okay. Just Food and Conference are three words I've heard together a lot. Is that the one up in Duluth, or is this a different one?
No, it was here in New York.
Okay.
I think it's always here in New York, but like, I covered it in one of my episodes where it was like 80% youth.
And oh, sweet.
Just like you said, it was like very progressive, but and the food was too, and it was like a play on the word just, because it was like, yeah, it's just food, like only, sure. But also justice, yeah. And justice, like every speaker there was all about like, you got to connect justice and food, like you cannot separate, yeah, them. It's not just about like eating, right? So shit, man, I wish I knew about it, right, sooner.
It's about the consumer.
Yeah, I'll send you a link to it. Maybe you've already seen it before. After it, I'll post it.
I've heard of it like on like social media and stuff, but I've never been.
Oh, sure. it was quite the. I wasn't expecting it. I was expecting to see some celebrity chef cook something, and it was not. It was like young people doing like rebellious work, like taking.
Well, maybe that's the key there, right? There was young people involved probably in planning that then as well, and we tend to have more aggressive form of, or a more modern understanding of what we want for a just food conference.
Yeah.
Like,
real quick before I go off on another chat, like, man, I'm telling you, man, this topic is like emotional. So I'm just like, it's good, but we can,
yeah.
Like I said, we could go on forever. I know you're like reaching the 30-minute mark, so I want to be like respectful of your time. So I wanted to wrap up with some questions that I pretty much ask every person who's been in the show. The questions are pretty, yeah, short. You can answer, mm-hmm, them as long as you want, but the questions will be pretty short. Cool?
Sure. Sounds like fun. Yeah.
All right. So first one, person who most influenced you from a farming / culinary standpoint and why?
Mm. Okay. So I have to choose one. I'm going to throw in Fred Christianman, Jenny Breen, Bob Dean. So there's other people I'm forgetting, I'm really sorry. But the person I'm going to choose is Mary Jo Forbord. She's a farmer in western Minnesota. Her and her husband, Laverne, are tremendously amazing people. She's a nutritionist, mm-hmm, by training, and also farms. And so she long ago started fighting and talking about and trying to figure out how like we connect nutrition and food. Because like, if you haven't been paying attention, the nutrition standards at the... that the, I don't know which government agency puts out, are just totally bogus from a standpoint of, like, actually having a healthy population, but are, like, pretty on point if you're someone selling soda processed or what, you know, whatever the fuck it might be. So she is totally amazing. And the way that they changed their farm from a conventional dairy into now grass-fed beef is an inspiring story. She's one of the people that I would say was really highly influential.
Like how they still convinced is. People that pizza is considered a serving,
yeah, the pizza as a tomato and the like margarine versus butter thing, like just for so long nutritionists are just tend to be so focused on the itty bitty details, and that's how we get dieting and all this stuff. And it's like, well, look, man, like there's a relatively simple way of just like eating a variety of things, you know, and try to eat a lot of vegetables, and like, and you end up with a pretty decent diet pretty quickly, yeah. They overcomplicate it. They make it like some domain of experts, like nutrition, and then the individual person feels overwhelmed, and they turn to diets and like rigorous rules and frivolous ideas when they're in the. They like turn over their dietary planning to like what's buy one get one that week, or like whatever the nutrition label says, like, yeah, at the person who's trying to sell you the shit. It gets weird.
It's a smokescreen.
Weird. Yeah.
Smokescreen. All right. Next one. Best either kitchen or farming tool you've purchased ever. And if it's a kitchen tool, besides the knife.
Okay, well, so I can't say chef's knife. So, the farm tool is a tractor. Tractor, man. You need a bucket on your tractor. It needs to have a 3-point hitch. And then you can just go to, you can get so much done. I'm telling you, I just got the tractor for the first time about a month ago. And there are so many projects I was like putting off because there's going to be like a ton of shovel work and take me forever. And it's just like, you know, it's in something I need to get done, but I don't have the time for that right now. I got to do other things. They take like 10 minutes with the tractor. You got to have a tractor. That's just, it was so many things in my life would have been so much simpler if I had it earlier. There's nothing else I can say about that. Tractors, I have, there's a reason. So like, for example, I don't want us to turn back the clock to when there weren't tractors in farming. I don't know that that's necessarily, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So there's some truth to the stereotype of the tractor driving farmer. there's an actual use and utility. So I normally ask this question in the form of three spices, but considering your background, three beers to describe you.
Oh God, that's great. Three is easier. I like the kind of modern IPA style that is hop forward without being too bitter. So like bitterness and hop flavor are like different things in a beer. Hops create bitterness, it's true, but they also create flavor. So I like aromatic IPAs. They're actually kind of in vogue right now too. That's what most of the styles tend to be. It's like they're floral or they're citrus. And I like that because it's kind of like me because I like flowers and I like think that smell really good. Yep. I'm really into scent. Otherwise, there's got to be like a bourbon-aged dark beer style, something stout, porter, whatever, in there because I like just that complex and heavy flavor experience that you get from things like that. And that's, I'm a complex person and can be heavy at times because food is heavy. Really fucked up. And like, you just gotta, okay, all right, I guess we're doing it. And then the third one would have to be a nice, crisp, craft version, of course, of like the American lager style, like a Helles or a Pilsner. There's nothing that's better because you can have one of those at noon when you're farming, and then you can have another couple when you're done for the day and sitting in the warm sun. That's perfect. That's just perfect.
Yeah. The drinkable, the really easy drink ones. Do you have an example of each of them? Just one
IPA that might be available out in the New York land is the modern IPA from Evil Twin Brewing, barrel aged bourbon porter stout thing. A lot of people do that. The one of the big deal ones every year is Goose Island's Bourbon Country.
Okay.
My favorite like kind of Pils Hell style is here in Minnesota, we have two that I would choose. There's a Bauhaus Brewing Company. Bauhaus Brew Labs actually is what their name is. And they make a Helles that's amazingly crisp. It's like just like a cracker experience. And then Fair State makes one called Pils. And it's a little bit sweeter, but it's still just as crisp. Highly carbonated styles. So good.
Two last questions. One book / documentary or resource of any kind for the common man.
Okay, so everyone has to read Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold.
What would you spell the first one?
Sand. Sand County Almanac.
Okay. Why?
Not directly about farming necessarily, but it's about he's a conservationist and it's about having a land ethic. Is his big idea. And everyone needs to read that so that they can understand how important land and place and space are to us as humans. I think it's really easy, really, really easy living in a city and living in modern times to not understand how important place is for you. And that book is an incredibly beautiful way of laying out why place is important. And even if you are a city slicker and you're not so into the conservation of like wild things or you're not too enamored by them, you can still take lessons out of what he writes to help you understand how to love and make space for yourself in a big city.
Nice. Adding that to the list. And so I know you're writing that.
Gotta read that. If you're so into this world, that's like that's a must read. Absolutely, you have to read that one. I mean,
I think that's what's good about these like podcast interviews is like I don't have to work on creating a book list because I just people like telling me what to read. It's perfect. So on the subject of books, I know you're writing one. I think the title is what, a collection of sorts.
Did I get correct. That right? Yep.
So
that'll be years, man. I'm a slow ass writer.
Hey,
it listen, turns out they the don't want you to publish a book unless you got enough stuff to put in it. So
the best things take time.
That's gonna take me a while.
But if you had to say, if there was like one line, like you're basically your one line message to the world in your book, what would that one line be?
That's so hard because like it's called a collection of sorts.
I know exactly.
All of essays that like have totally, relatively different topics. Something I might encourage everyone to do, maybe the point of it is to live a intentional and a reflective life, which maybe it doesn't sound directly related to farming, but for me, if you're like really digging into some questions about like your basic sustenance and like basic needs as a human to feel whole, you're gonna find yourself gardening at least.
Yeah,
you can't get far from it
if you're trying. It's definitely related. There's a good small booklet that I actually got that's pretty fun by a Zen Buddhist. His name is like Thich Nhat Hanh or something. It's called How to Eat. It's like, or something like that. And it's the funnest book ever. He's like, yeah, you know, when you're chewing on your food, like think how much work actually went into that and your dining experience will be that much better.
Is that where that Zen prayer comes from? The Zen meal prayer?
It might be. I don't know if he came up with it, but like the ideas of that are in that book, and it's really, really fun. Oh,
so cool.
I lied. There is one last question, but it's more logistical. So, if people wanted to follow your story, I mean, like you're all over the place, so I don't even know which part of the story to send. Like, I'm gonna put your bio on the site, and it's like people can figure out which part interests them the most. But if you wanted people to follow your story, where would they go?
So my personal Twitter is just Eric Sanerud. And Mighty Axe Hops is on Twitter and Facebook as well.
Okay.
Those are kind of the main ways. Otherwise, people can email me. I'm just ericrsanerud@gmail.com.
Nice. Hopefully, if the TED Talk's out in time, because I have a couple more episodes to put up before this one.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I could.
I did see a first draft of it recently, so presumably it's close. I don't know.
All right. Well, either way, we'll make sure it gets out there. Yeah, it's pretty much it. I mean, I'm not lying. There's still like double the amount of questions on this page, which we will leave for another time. But this is a really good start. Thanks so much for indulging me, man.
It's really fun to like go from we've never even met each other in person, right?
No. No.
You know, like we like randomly got connected and I like told you like five names of farms, and then through that conversation,
that's a lie because there was way like, more than five names
there was
on
like
that list.
So many, there was like so many things that we had in common and things to talk about. I mean, we'll run into each other one of these days. You're in Minneapolis, sounds like fairly often, and I'm, you know, in New York, you know, regularly at least. So, we should send people to my website. I forgot I have that.
Oh, I have. Just like, that's weird. Like I actually have it open right now.
Like that should be the place people can go to keep up on my stuff, because I'll keep that up to date and like post links to things there too.
Okay.
Well, I do have to go now.
Likewise, I gotta go eat dinner.
Yeah, me too.
Jesus. Thanks again, man. I'll hit you up.
See you later. Bye.
Peace.